Welcome to the podcast of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta, where we are committed to changing lives with faith, hope, and love. We're so glad you are here.
All right, so today we're talking about Philo of Alexandria in particular, but really Jewish biblical interpretation around the time of Jesus. So we're talking, this class is, you know, sort of about the intertestamental period. Philo actually is someone who lives about the time of Jesus. They overlap in terms of their lifespans, but he dies before the New Testament begins to be written. That is, so Philo is someone who is a contemporary of Jesus, but is wrote very, it seems, very influential texts that actually informed the earliest Christian texts. So like I said, if you've ever been wondering where the Logos comes from, that's one thing we'll talk about today, and it at least was influenced by the way that Christians understand the Logos. The word was influenced by Philo. So, one big picture thing is that Philo represents a strand of Judaism that was very popular at the time that he lived. We'll talk a little bit about why his strand of Judaism didn't exist much longer. It exists, but in a very changed form after the time of his lifespan, and it existed in kind of the margins of Jewish culture. But this is like my little map of like where are we in terms of Israelite religion to Judaism to Christianity. If we think about the Old Testament for the most part represents what I would call ancient Israelite religion, a religion of sacrifice in the temple, a religion that is thoroughly involved in ancient Mesopotamian and Egyptian and Canaanite religious ideas and images like the cherubim. The idea of a temple of the Holy of Holies, right? These are ancient Near Eastern practices and ideas that were also used in ancient Israelite religion, right? So ancient Israelite religion then transforms into other things. That is the Samaritans, which who are a continuing sect, right? They still worship today on Mount Gerizim. There are still people who are worshiping Samaritans. They have their own version of the Bible. They only use the Pentateuch, the first five books, and they use a slightly different version of the Pentateuch. In which the Holy Mountain is not Zion, but the Holy Mountain is Mount Gerizim, where the Samaritans have always worshipped. So you have this Samaritan group that comes out of ancient Israelite religion, but is not Jewish. So Jewish means people from Judah, like southern Israel, right? So the southern tribe of Judah, they become the Jews. But they continue to exist after the northern tribes have been dispersed and scattered and conquered. And those are the Samaritan folk, right? So the Samaritans and the Jews both worship Yahweh, the God of Israel, and they both claim a historical sort of belonging in Israel. But we would call Judaism the religion of the people of Judah. There's debates about when exactly this begins, but sometime around the return from the exile. And one of the amazing distinctive features of Judaism, as opposed to ancient Israelite religion, is that it is a primarily text-based religion. They are strangely bookish. So when Ezra comes back from exile in the book of Nehemiah chapter 8 and 9, he reads this big, long book, and all the people gather around to hear this book. Now, they also have rebuilt the temple. There is temple worship, so ancient Israelite religion that is temple-based sacrifice still continues, but there's also this other thing that's emerging, that is what we would now call Judaism, a religion based in synagogue worship, gathering together as lay people, in a house of study, to study scriptures and to pray, and the prayer of the people in ways substitutes for sacrifices in the temple. That's actually a parallel institution to temple worship during the life of Jesus. Jesus visits synagogues and he visits the temple. So they are not exclusive of one another, but they are different forms of religious worship. And we would say they're different religious forms. And they have some different ideas. That is to say, the religion of the temple doesn't seem to have been as bookish as the religion of the synagogue. When Jesus reads the scrolls and so on, that's part of synagogue worship. That's not part of temple worship. You don't go to the temple and read the scrolls all day. You go to the temple, you do the sacrifices. You perform the rituals, the liturgies. So, all to say, this is a different kind of religion. Also, it's different from the peoples of the ancient Near East and the peoples of the Mediterranean world. There's a great example. So there's a cult, a particular religious cult, that arises about the same time as Christianity. And it arises in about the same place, that is the Mediterranean world. It's Jupiter Dulcinus, this kind of worship of Jupiter in the Roman army in particular. And it grows at about the same rate and size. It then dies out while Christianity kind of continues to grow, but it's a great comparison about these kind of new religious ideas that emerge about the same time in the Roman world. And what's crazy is that we've got tons of buildings of this particular version of worship of Jupiter, and we know exactly who was involved because they left inscriptions of who built these temple kind of things. And we know it was popular within the upper echelons of the Roman army, that is, the generals of the Roman army and so on had this particular kind of worship. We know nothing other than that. They left buildings, and they left inscriptions with their names, but they left no texts. And this is not uncommon. This is just the way ancient worship, the mystery cults of Dionysus and stuff. We know some of their stories because of their myths, but we know very little about them in particular because they didn't write much. Now, opposite of that, Christianity left an unbelievable amount of texts, but left no material remains other than texts until the 3rd century. That is to say, Christians had a very different way of thinking about religion, and this comes from Judaism. That is to say, Judaism is the religion of the book, the first religion that we know of in the world that was truly a religion of the book. So we're going to get to that. That is important because Philo is one of the people that represents this massive change towards a way of trying to use this book to interpret in new and different ways, allegorical ways, to try to kind of update it for their own time and space. So anyway, Second Temple Judaism starts about the year 515 or so at the completion of the Second Temple, and then continues until 70 AD, when the temple is destroyed after the time of Jesus by the Romans. And from there, we get these different kind of small groups that then grow. There's, of course, chaos after the temple is destroyed. But then you have Christian groups, which were originally, and actually for many centuries, difficult to discern from Jewish groups. That is to say, the difference between Christian and Jew was really hard to negotiate for several centuries. Christians would say, I'm a Jew, and I'm a Christian Jew, or Jews would sometimes say, well, those people are kind of like us, but not really. That is to say that there was a complicated work of dividing what Christians and Jews were. But also you've got these other types of Judaism. We would say rabbinic Judaism, which became what today, when you talk about Jews today, you're talking about mainly rabbinic Jews. That is to say, from Orthodox to Reform Judaism, that's rabbinic Judaism. A Judaism led by the people who claim to be descendants of the Pharisees, lay people, who were focused on the law, reading the scrolls, the holy texts in synagogue, and praying together as a substitution for the sacrifices in the temple. That's the rabbinic movement. And they have particular ways of reading texts that we'll get into in the spring. Midrash is one of those ways, when you notice problems in the text, and you don't say, well, that means the text is wrong or something, but you say this is a prompt for us to investigate further. It's an interesting way of reading, but also trying to apply the law in different contexts. Well, what are we supposed to do now that we don't live this way that's described in the law of Moses? The laws don't go away. How do we reapply them in our own day and age? That's a big part of rabbinic Judaism. So there's also other branches of Judaism that weren't ever quite as big and continue today, but in smaller form, like the Samaritans, but they come out of Second Temple Judaism. One of them is mystical Judaism. So if you've ever heard of Kabbalah, right, Kabbalah is not made up in the 20th century, right? Britney Spears didn't make it up, or whatever. It is a venerated tradition within the Jewish, sort of part of the Jewish tradition. It doesn't overlap entirely with rabbinic Judaism. That is to say, many Jews would go to synagogue, but also do this other thing that the rabbis would say, don't do that, don't do Kabbalah, right? But it is, it has its roots in esotericism that comes from the Middle East, but also from the Western world, kind of a mixture of the Roman and Eastern worlds. And it comes from Second Temple Judaism. Philo of Judaeus, Philo of Alexandria, is the guy we'll talk about today who's a part of the foundation of this mystical Judaism. This is where Kabbalah comes from. Much later, Kabbalah is really a medieval practice, but it has its roots in the Hellenistic world. There's also what we call Karaite Judaism, which I won't get into right now, but it's a very different form of Judaism than Rabbinic Judaism. And it's actually, these are the folks who put together the Bible in the way that we have it, the Masoretic scribes who put together, when I pick up an Old Testament written in Hebrew, I'm picking up their Old Testament, the Karaites, because they were focused entirely on the text. They were really more scribally focused than the rabbinic Jews, and they had different ideas. They were kind of like the Reformed versus Catholic. Like the Karaites believed in the text and the text only. So anyway, there still are some Karaite Jews today, but they've mainly died out. So that is to say, when you're talking about Jews today, you're mainly talking about rabbinic Jews. But just to say, this is kind of a war with what we've been looking at this semester, is these Second Temple Judaisms, these different forms of Second Temple religion that end up eventuating in these different forms that we can see today, mainly Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism. But they have a common ancestry. So all to say that this is today we'll be looking at one of these kind of forking points into mystical Judaism. Okay, so where the setting for today's discussion is Alexandria, the city of Alexandria, right in Egypt, right on the coast. We've talked about it a few times so far this semester, but think of a massive cosmopolitan metropolis, one of the largest city in the world, the most scholarly city in the world, the place where the museum, the museion, the place of the muses, where all the ideas of museums come from, right? The first ever semi-public space for learning that was funded by a massive government. Let's say that this is a new idea in the history of the world. It also contained the library at Alexandria, the first semi-public library ever. It was not a private holding of one king. It was a state-funded library project that tried to collect all the known texts in the world, and it funded scholars who lived there who then produced new forms of scholarship. One of the things that they did was textual scholarship. They compared all the different ancient versions of Homer and tried to find which one was right. That is, if you got 100 versions of Homer and all of them disagree on certain points, which one's the true Homer? So they had people who sat down and came up with ideas of editing texts and figuring out which, like, kind of making a critical version of the text, which version is the right one. Was this line added later? Was this version corrupted by a scribe at some point? They literally invented these methods. These became very important for early Christians, including Origen, who we'll talk about next semester, who is important for creating what we know of as our Bible. So anyway, these methods of kind of scholarly analysis that were developed in Alexandria were learned by many Jews as well. So Jews were one of the second largest population, maybe the third largest after Egyptians, but in Alexandria. So the Greek and later Roman inhabitants of Alexandria were probably the largest sort of ethnic identity and definitely the largest linguistic identity that lived in Alexandria. Everyone else had to learn Greek. Even the Romans who moved to Alexandria, they all learned Greek. That is to say, Pilate didn't speak Latin like he did in the Passion of the Christ, right? Pilate would have spoken Greek. Everyone in the Eastern Roman Empire spoke Greek and Greek only. They would have spoken a little bit of Latin. But Greek was the main language of administration, even in the Roman Empire, even until today, right? You know, the Byzantine right, culture is Greek-speaking. They still call themselves the descendants of the Romans. So, all to say, Alexandria was a melting pot of even Greek people coming from Greece, from different parts of Greece, which had different identities, like the Spartans and the Athenians, right? People from Cyprus, people from Kos, all these different regional differences between the Greeks, but also Romans began to come. There was a melting pot of people from different parts of Egypt who had to move there for work, and of course, this provided an opportunity for different other ethnicities from around the Ptolemaic Empire. To be able to kind of set up shop there as well, including the Jews, who then become, miraculously almost, no one knows how this happened, but they flourished. That is to say, we don't have a lot of information about exactly how there became so many Jews living in Alexandria, but by the time of Jesus, there are 1 million Jews living in Alexandria. There are maybe 30,000 living in Jerusalem. That is to say, Alexandria was the center of Judaism. amazingly so, and they produced the world's largest and only known attempt to translate the entire body of scripture into another language. It's part of their bookishness, that is the Septuagint, the Greek translation of all of the Old Testament, which if you've ever held the Bible and actually looked at how much text there's a heck of a lot. Think about translating all of that when no one else in the world has tried to do that before. So they invented the idea of large translation projects. So all to say, the Jews living in Alexandria were intelligent, they were learned, they were also thoroughly Hellenized. They were part of this Greek culture, and they were wondering, how do I retain my Jewishness? What's the important part to keep, and what do I leave behind? That was the big struggle of the day. Do I have to throw away the stuff that I learned in school? So if Jews want to be scribes, if they want to work in the administration, which a lot of people would want to do, I would guess, it's a pretty nice place to be and a nice position to have a good steady working government in the ancient world. So if you wanted to work in that position, you'd have to go to school, Greek school. You'd also have to go to Jewish school to like learn what it meant to be a Jew. But then also you'd go to Greek school and you'd learn all of Homer, you'd learn all of Plato, you'd learn all of Aristotle. You would read all the great things. You'd memorize tons of Greek facts, and so on. You want to become culturally Greek in order to pass as someone who could work in the Greek administration. But also you'd want to retain your Jewish identity in some way, or at least many Jews did. So Philo represents that tension, and he does it. This is not not really a picture of Philo. This is like the only, like there are no pictures of Philo. But this is what some reformer in the 16th century thought Philo might have looked like. He didn't look like this. But imagine a Greek philosopher who was thinking in some way about trying to retain his Jewish identity. So Philo Judaeus, which means Philo the Jew, but also his, Philo of Alexandria is another name that people have that give him, Philo the guy who lived in Alexandria, which at the time of most of his life was a Roman province in Egypt. So his parents are unknown, but his brother is famous. And by his brother's name and his function, which Philo explains, we know that he was from a very wealthy family. We also know that he was a Roman citizen, which was a really difficult thing for Jews to obtain. So Paul claims to this, right? You know, so this is, it's a rare thing. It's a special marker of kind of identity if you can claim Roman citizenship. He was eventually, we'll talk about this at the end of class today, he was sent on a delegation to Caligula. Personally, to try to make peace with Caligula, because there were several riots happening in Alexandria. So he was really important within the Jewish community. They trusted him to be their ambassador to the Roman emperor on a matter of extreme urgency. We also know that his brother was the main tax collector for imports from the east in Alexandria. So very, very wealthy guy. He, his brother, paid for the gold doors on the temple for Herod's temple. One of Philo's nieces ended up marrying into the Herodian family. So Herod the Great's, one of the Herod the Great's. So anyway, there's kind of marriage alliances between Philo and the Herods. So this all to say that he had sort of classical Greek education. We know this from his writings. But we also know that he had this intense tie to the land of Israel and to Judah itself. We also know that he visited the second temple. He was really proud of the fact that he had traveled to Jerusalem to visit the temple and so on. So he's in this interesting space. So what does he do if he wants to retain his faith in, and he really does believe in Greek philosophy. He calls himself a philosopher. He styles himself as a philosopher. That seems to have been what he primarily did. That is to say, his brother earned a lot of money, and Philo probably comes from money. Philo ends up going through all this Greek schooling, and he becomes, I don't know, an author? Like, I mean, that's like kind of what he, you know, I don't know what he would call himself, but he would call himself a philosopher, I think. So he's interested in trying to prove that it's persuasive speech. He's trying to prove that the Torah is right, but through using Greek philosophy, which sounds maybe like a strange thing to do, but this is, syncretism is what people might call this, right? He's trying to kind of meld Greek philosophy and Judaism, particularly through the Torah. At the same time, I mean, this is my argument about Christianity, especially. Like, there is nothing but syncretism. So, Jewish culture, ancient Israelite religion, comes out of a Canaanite background. Sorry, they just have Canaanite practices, like Holy of Holies. That's a Canaanite thing, to have your temple built that way, and so on. Sacrifice of animals. Everyone does this in the ancient Near East. Even the songs they sing, the hymns they sing, sound exactly like the hymns of people around them, except you take out the name of whatever god you're worshiping, you put in Yahweh. Psalm 29, we know that this is actually a hymn to Baal, that the Israelites took out Baal, put in Yahweh. We know this in part because there's some textual evidence of some changes, but also Baal actually works in the poetry and Yahweh doesn't for Psalm 29. So you can just see that like they were coming, and this is, I think, the way God works. God works through talking to people in places where they are in language that they already understand, or at least in part, and God helps people move from there. So that is to say, we shouldn't be surprised by God's kind of incarnational work within cultures and so on. But Philo is a key point here because there's a new culture that's really dominating Judaism at the time, that is Greco-Roman culture. And the question is, do we reject entirely what this new culture has, or do we try to embrace it in a way? But embrace it in a way that doesn't do away with our own understandings. So what Philo does is he uses these Greek modes of interpretation, primarily allegory, which is a way that so Greeks are smart, right? They spend a lot of time thinking, or at least some of them, the philosophers. They kind of developed the idea of what they would call rational philosophy, right? There's a lot of debate about all those terms and so on. But anyway, the Greeks are pretty good at reflective thought, at least at the time. What they do with Homer, like the Greeks know from a very early point on that Homer sounds funny, right? You read the Homeric myths and you don't see gods like that walking around. What do we do with these things? Of course, some people just believe them. Some people think that they're great stories and so on. You start to get some people who question whether the gods exist. Then you have some of the philosophers that begin to say, well, maybe these stories are true, but in a way, right? So maybe Zeus doesn't exist, but Zeus like represents something, or Demeter represents grain, and Dionysus represents wine, right? The stuff that wine does, Dionysus acts crazy. Well, that's what wine makes you do, right? So all to say, like, they're reinterpreting these things as symbols, and they're trying to speak about the truth of the world in a different way, so an allegory. The Stoics, which we'll talk about in a moment, are primarily interested in this, and this is something that appeals to Philo. That is to say, and we'll get to some details of this in a minute, Philo, even in the Hellenistic world, they knew enough science to know that Genesis 1 doesn't work. They knew. Right, Democritus talks about the atom. Right, they had incredible astronomical knowledge. They didn't quite know exactly what they were, but they had enough geometry and calculus. It wasn't quite invented yet, but they understood rates of change somewhat enough to be able to predict things like eclipses, even 1,000 years into the future. They knew a lot about the movement of the bodies of the stars, and they were able to calculate during the Hellenistic period the circumference of the Earth to within a few thousand miles. A few hundred miles, sorry. They knew, they pretty much predicted how far away the sun was. Like, they knew enough science to know that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 sound a little fishy. So what did they do? They read this. So Philo says, well, maybe we can read these texts allegorically in the same way that the Homeric folks are reading things now allegorically. So we'll get into more about this in particular. But one of the things that's important about Philo is that he also says, I'm not going to do away with the literal notion of the text. That is to say, maybe I don't think the science all accords. But there is something that's not symbolic about some of these things that is important too. So Philo kind of draws a middle way that Paul ends up really adopting. And we'll get to some kind of bizarre comparisons in just a moment. So, this is one of the things that that one of Philo's followers said that I think that really sums up Philo really well is, "What is Plato but Moses speaking in Greek?" So he's in the context of Hellenistic philosophy. The basic idea of Hellenistic philosophy, that is philosophy that comes after the time of Alexander, as opposed to like Plato and Aristotle, who were before the time of Alexander, right? So if you think about politically, the time before Alexander, there's city-states, right? Like Sparta, but also like Athens, and Athens is the place that produces the most philosophers. Why? Because they're interested in the question of how citizens govern their own state, right? Every citizen needs to be smart because we make our decisions together, at least the citizens who are free and who own property and who are male, etc., right? There's a lot of limitations, but still, they have more than just one person making decisions. So we need to have an educated and thoughtful populace to be able to make these decisions. So we need to have philosophy. We need to have people who are educated in asking rational questions and thinking carefully about what we want to be, right? What is the good life? What do we all want to do as a state? So Plato and Aristotle are interested in big questions about like metaphysics and things like what's the nature of God in the world and so on. But really, ultimately, they're interested in what makes good people and what makes a good life, because we're all responsible for this now, right? Like, the decisions we make are going to matter for all of us. So how do we live the good life? What is a good life? Plato had, one of his big ideas is, how do we build a big state? What do we do, right? So, I mean, the Republic, right? This whole big thing about, like, how do we build an ideal state? Because it's now our responsibility. Well, in the Hellenistic period, after Alexander the Great, city-states go away. You don't have, the individual person, even powerful rich people, don't have much power in terms of deciding what the state does anymore. Philosophy responds to this. Philosophy of the Hellenistic period, the stuff that you've heard of, like Cynics and Stoics and Skeptics, Epicureans, these all emerge in the Hellenistic, they've emerged somewhat before that, but they become very popular in the Hellenistic period precisely because people lose their power to be able to work the state. So now they're responding to, like, basically the wills, everyone is in the Mediterranean basin area is responding to the wills of tyrants. So instead of managing the state, now you have to manage yourself. That's all you can do. So it turns inward. Philosophy is all about you, your personal life. What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to live? So this individual way of, how are you going to find a happy life in the midst of a crazy world? Some of you may resonate. Yeah, sounds a little familiar, right? So the goal of Hellenistic philosophy is eudaimonia, or the good life. Plato would also say this is his goal, but his goal was a good state that would produce a good life. In the midst of a state that's not going to work right, what can you do to produce your own happy life? Or, as we might call it today, living your best life. This is basically philosophy. So some of the different schools, one is cynicism, the cynics. You know, don't be a cynic, right? Well, what do the cynics actually believe? The cynics, at least there's, again, I'm summarizing too much and cutting off edges of these arguments, but just for the sake of time, basically cynics say you should live a life in agreement with virtue and nature to find happiness, right? So the world exists in a certain way. You're supposed to just go with the flow, a little bit like Tao. But the best way, according to at least some of the founders like Anisthenes and Diogenes, Diogenes being the most famous one, is that you're really supposed to follow, just don't worry about possessions. Possessions are the things that get in the way the most. So just live your life going with the flow of everything. Don't have a house. Don't have a farm. You know, just kind of wander around. And so the cynics are called the dogs. Actually, you know, this begins when Diogenes is teaching. He teaches in a place that's like the temple of the white dog. But people end up calling them the dogs because they wander around and scavenge for food. And, you know, and the idea is that this lead, like, they're happy because they're carefree, right? They're like living a nomadic wandering existence and so on. This might appeal to some folks. This might not appeal to others. But they were seen as kind of crazy, strange people. This does sound a little bit like some of those early Christians that wander around and don't really care much about possessions, right? And are talking about how do you live the best life? Like, how do you live a life that is most ethical and moral, right? So there, you can think of maybe even Paul as someone who is primarily nomadic, wandering around and talking to people about how they should live their best life, right? So in any event, and Christians are sometimes called dogs too. So, but I also love that sometimes Diogenes would actually bark at people, just to make them go away if they were trying to pick on him or something like that, right? So opposed to the cynics or like another different variant, what was the Stoics? Again, these begin before or just about the beginning of the period of Hellenism, but these schools emerge and develop over time. But Zeno of Citium, this is him right here, and he is understood to be the founder of the Stoics. And so when you think of Stoics, you think of someone who just kind of sits there and takes abuse or pain or something and doesn't budge, right? Well, there's a bigger idea behind it. The idea of Stoicism is that the universe itself, all that exists is God. God is the universe, right? So pantheism in a way, right? God is the entire universe. The things that we see are like little elements of this universe that are represented as individual objects, right? So there's this divine, it's not just everything is God. Everything is part of this divine spirit, mind, that actually produces new ideas and thoughts. It animates the universe. It ties it all together. It's a creative kind of thing that's all emerging at the same time. And we have every independent individual person has some independent mind. Like, we can push back against this divine, even though we're part of it. We can, like, kind of fight. You know, you've ever had a fight with yourself? Like, you know, should I do this? Should I not do this? Right? It's kind of an inner fight between God when you push back against the kind of the larger idea of the divine spirit. So you can, like, live in contradiction to it, or you can live with the divine spirit. If you live with the divine spirit, you're going to have a good life, eudaimonia. If you push against the divine spirit by trying to grab possessions and wealth and power, if it hurts other people, you're going to be hurting yourself, really, because you're part of a larger divine spirit, and you're going to feel that tension and anger within yourself. So if you're going to deal with your passions in a good way, then you have to kind of go with the flow of the universe. Their way of talking about this unifying force of the universe, the divine reason and logic, and anyone guess the Greek word they use to describe this? The logos. This is where the idea of logos comes from. Like the beginning of John, the word. In the beginning was the word. They are borrowing Stoic ideas, but they're not borrowing them directly from the Stoics. They're borrowing them from Philo, the Greek-speaking Jew who begins to write philosophy about what this logos actually is if you read Genesis 1. Okay, so anyway, that's the basic idea. The idea is you kind of go through life accepting things without complaint. That's how you kind of find happiness. That is to say, they're not just like, I'm going to tough it out. Their way of dealing with the pains of the universe is to say, I'm actually bigger than this. Like, I am part of this whole universe, right? It's kind of a Zen thing in a way. Disturbances to me are disturbances in the larger universe, and I'm going to accept this as part of the universal story and kind of play my part, but also to kind of, in a way, accept the way that God has decided to do things. So I'm part of the logos. This doesn't mean you just accept everything. You can try to get into touch with the divine logos and then work in politics even, although Stoics were pretty famous for saying it's probably not a good idea to get involved in politics because you know, again, you're going to be working with these kings, and you're going to, they're probably ones that don't actually work very well with the state. There are some famous Stoics later on in Roman history, like Marcus Aurelius, who end up becoming very powerful themselves. So that is to say, it's not against the idea of politics, but it's you have to approach it differently than most of us would, the idea of power. Okay, so another different school is Epicureans, which if you hear of an Epicurean, you probably think of someone who, I don't know, likes to eat a lot, or, you know, like somebody who focuses on their own pleasure. This is kind of true, but Epicureans are very different from the Stoics in the sense that they say that there's no universal logos out there. That's a lie. That's to make you feel, it's a lie to make you feel better. Just accept that the world has no meaning. That's the first thing, right? That's just going to make you, that's a Pollyanna thing, you know, it's just going to lead you down the wrong path. Instead, you need to understand that the world is actually kind of out to get you. So instead, follow, and this is where it's different than what we expect. Epicureans don't say eat as much as you want, whatever, you know, like you're just, you know, find pleasure, you know, do drugs, you know, find pleasure wherever you want, right? The idea of Epicureanism actually is modesty, like in all things, like in kind of the moderate way, right? So seek modest pleasure, avoid fear, try to avoid bad things that are going to make you feel bad, but also avoid, you know, bad feelings that come from getting too much of what we might think of as pleasure. And so find the middle way. That's kind of more the Epicurean desire. So Epicurus himself lived in a nice garden. He walled his house and basically built this nice little garden, and he would just kind of make tea every day and hang out in this nice little garden and have some people in to chat, you know, and so on. That's more what Epicureanism is, like a small, manageable life with small pleasures that you indulge in, and you try to basically push fear and concern away. And you can see how this, there are some people today who probably this sounds about right, you know, to some folks. But also you can see how this might conflict in some ways with Christian and Jewish ideas about justice and about a community, right? So in any event, another big idea out there, also in some conflict with Judaism and Christianity at the time, was skepticism. Now skeptics, right, you know, they don't believe stuff, right? That's the basic idea, you know, kind of a critical eye to all things. There's different schools of skepticism in the ancient world, what we call the academic skeptics. Arcesilaus is from about 264 BC or so, understood to be kind of the founder of the academic school of skeptics, right, in the beginning of the Hellenistic period. And the basic idea is that the universe is always changing, so it's all in constant flux. There's so much change that, you can't actually know things. When you say something, it might already be different and change. So you have to kind of accept a radical limitation of our own knowledge, even our sense knowledge. Right, so this is kind of the basic foundational idea of the skeptics, which does come into in plays with all these different ideas, right? Tends to be most upset at the Stoics for their idea of this universal God that's in everything, and you know they're like, come on, that sounds absolutely ridiculous, which is where we get skepticism from. So another school that was really important, but also considered strange at the time. Almost like secret knowledge was the Pythagoreans. Now, if you know about Pythagoras, it's because of
geometry,
which I'm sorry to say, he might have had nothing to do with any of that. It is very contested whether or not he even did anything involving math that was like his own ideas or anything like that. But he inspired people to be very interested in math because he was not really a geometric, you know, he was not a mathematician. What he really was an esotericist. He was a mystic. So he believed that numbers had within them mystical, allegorical, symbolic meanings. And so if you played with math, so he's also associated with music, the idea of scales, and if you divide a string in half and pluck it, that you're going to play the octave, you're going to say it's going to be the same note, but one octave up, right? So this kind of mathematical, the fifths and thirds, right? He really devises a musical scale that is just separating strings at certain numbers, but then finds out that makes a pleasing kind of harmonious arrangement of music, right? So he thinks this is all spiritual, right? So he's interested in music, he's interested in math, but primarily because he's interested in finding God. So he has what people at the time would have called a cult. People gave up their possessions, lived in common with one another. He's from 570 BC, but his followers actually became more famous and popular through the Hellenistic period. So by the time of Jesus, there's lots of Pythagoreans out there that are living in these communities that have given up all their possessions and so on, and are just basically involved in crazy math, symbolic math, like many of us would say, I don't know what you're talking about, right? But also a belief that the whole, like one is the most important number because the cosmos is one, everything's one. But then like two and three have all these symbolic meanings. So let me just, I've got a couple of these. So four signifies the four seasons, the four elements. Three is important because it's beginning, middle, and end. It's like the beginnings, like kind of the all things. Two represents matter because, like, you know, things are kind of opposed to one another. 10 they think is the perfect numbers, so they never gathered in groups larger than 10. So, I mean, you know, it was symbolic, mystical, and so on. But this is, you know, you can sort of understand now, okay, so he was interested in geometry, or maybe his followers were interested in geometry in part because they thought the relationships between the angles of a triangle, the sides of a triangle had something to do with God. It's why they're interested in all this stuff, right? Very different from, say, Archimedes, who was just interested in math for math's sake, it seems. In any event, yeah, but you can think a little bit about how this might have influenced early Christianity and Judaism, not just because of the kind of communal living thing, but also this symbolic, mystical approach to numbers, which resonates somewhat with ancient Jewish thought or Israelite thought. 3 and 7 are big numbers and so on. But also there were groups of Jews, including the Therapeutai and maybe even the Dead Sea Scroll sect, that borrowed some of these ideas and actually turned them into a Jewish form of life. Now, we don't know much about these Jewish Therapeutai, but they were there was a large group of people living west of Alexandria who created this community and gave up all their wealth and so on. And Philo talks about them, but Josephus talks about them. They were talked about in other texts of the time. So it's a really famous group of Jews that follow this Pythagorean lifestyle and try to kind of meld it into Jewish thought. Now, Philo knows these folks. And they have been hugely inspirational to him. So he starts to read the Bible through the lens of this kind of number theory stuff. Some of this does get into Jewish tradition. If you've ever heard of gematria, kind of the symbolic ideas about numbers in the Bible and so on in Jewish thought, this comes from this mode of thinking, but also in Christian thought. Some early Christians, including Paul, start to kind of listen to some of these ideas. Yeah.
In modern times, do we try to combine cynicism with skepticism? Because a cynic is a doubter.
Yeah.
He's very skeptical.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the
cynics and skeptics in the Hellenistic period would have argued with one another about how do we then, what's the ethical outcome? And in that way, each of the cynics and each of the skeptics would have had different ways of arguing with each other. So it gets kind of tricky from there. But just to say, in the ancient world, the skeptics would have, they would not, their ethics are not ascetic like the cynics would have been. The cynics say, reject possessions, don't have a home, don't have long-lasting connections to other people, just kind of wander around and so on. And that's the best way to live life. The skeptics are academics. Primarily, and there are people who they think that having possessions is not a bad thing. They also wonder if you can know what the good life is. So there's they might sound similar to us, but they occupy very different social parts of the spectrum and have very different kind of ethical outcomes. So people who are attracted to the cynic way of life would have thought the skeptics were loser sellouts. You know, they don't really believe in what they think. You know, and the skeptics would have said, those Stoics, they're living like dogs in the street, right? I mean, that's not what this is all about. So, in any event, but yes, we can look at them today and maybe think that there are elements that overlap of their thought. And that is true, I think. Yeah, good point.
Is that where some of the things come from, like 40 days and 40 nights and 12 disciples? I mean,
yeah, so there were symbolic numbers in the ancient world. 40 was a good symbolic number and so on that existed before this kind of... If you ever read some like Christian interpreters that get kind of too into the numbers, you know, 40 just in the ancient Near East, 40 means a good round number. When you read like this person lived 40 years or ruled for 40 years, that means we don't know exactly how long. A couple generations, you know, like a while. That means a long time. You know, it's kind of how they said a long time. But
interestingly, in the statistics, 40 means enough samples normally.
Yeah, sure.
The exact number is really precise, but I mean...
N equals, right, yeah, yeah.
But most statisticians say, well, if I've got 40, that's good enough.
Good enough, yeah. So it's kind of good enough, yeah, in the ancient world too. But Philo and the Pythagoreans, right, would look at those numbers and say there's part of the secret of the universe is buried in these numbers. So it's much more interested in kind of like locating the numbers and interpreting them. But larger than that is just this idea of allegory. That like the truth of this text is kind of buried in a way, and you need to get to it through symbolic interpretation. So, in any event, back to Philo. So most of Philo's surviving works, he wrote a whole lot, much of it preserved only in Armenian, amazingly, preserved mostly in the Christian tradition, because Jewish philosophers ended up not thinking Philo was going down the right path after the destruction of the temple. There was a shift towards rabbinic Judaism, which we'll talk about in the spring. But so Philo, for his day, was hugely important, I think, and popular. We can say that he was kind of a combination of classical Greek thought. He loved Plato. He really wanted to prove that Plato was right about some of the things like the Plato's ideas of the origins of the world. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But he also thought that that Moses was saying the same stuff. So he wanted to kind of combine Moses and Plato, and especially his form of Platonism. Plato's, the ideals, the ideas that kind of exist out in the world beyond and so on, and we're with a shadow world of the ideals and so on. Yeah, so by the time of Philo, Plato has been combined with the Stoics. It's basically become like a Stoic. It's a Stoic reading of Plato. So the idea of the Logos and so on. Plato never says anything about the Logos, but now anyone who says I'm a Platonist at the time of Philo, they would be meaning this particular reading. Like Middle Platonism is what people call it now. No one then called it that, but nonetheless. So you can see, if you read through Philo, he's interpreting, basically he has one big book on Genesis, which has been broken up into little parts now, but basically he's trying to interpret Genesis to try to say, here's how you can read about the creation of the world and see that if Plato loves Moses and Moses loves Plato. In fact, he says Moses lived before Plato, which is true historically. So that means that Plato learned everything he knew from Moses. So that is, the Greeks got a hold of the Torah somehow and then lost it, but in the meantime learned all of its knowledge, and that's where all Greek philosophy comes from. And all Greek technology comes from that too, right? So as I said, it's kind of his way of explaining it, and which became very popular and even is found in rabbinic literature of the Middle Ages and so on. If you want to kind of sum up what Philo believes, I mean, he believes in a transcendent God without physical features, beyond kind of any human form and so on, or really kind of beyond emotional qualities. Like the Old Testament will say God got angry, God got upset, and what Philo says is that's all symbolic, right? God really is beyond that. It's kind of like the Platonic idea of this kind of divinity, kind of beyond a human form, really an ideal God. So Philo also says that we can know something about God because God has kind of acted in the world. He follows, and this is a tension that you'll see in early Christianity throughout the New Testament. We'll talk about this. But in the Greek world, there's a division between the world of matter and the world of ideas, or spiritual things, which are understood to be the same. When you think, there's no thing that's, we now know there's electrical impulses, et cetera, that are happening. But for ancient Greek, when you think, there's no thing there. You can imagine a circle. To the Greeks, they thought that's kind of magical. You can imagine something that's not here. But instead of thinking that was like worse or not as good, the idea was that was like linked to this, the true world, which is not composed of matter. Because matter, stuff, it decays, it decomposes, it falls apart, it's broken, or it can break and so on. It must be bad then. So we live in this kind of mortal coil, right? This kind of world of stuff that's going to break and fall apart and it's bad ultimately. But we're trying to ascend to the good world of ideas, which is not full of matter. And so this is that's a Greek idea. It's really different from the ancient Near East. Mesopotamians didn't think this. Ancient Judahites didn't think this, or Israelites did not think this about, like, they didn't think they had an eternal soul that marched on after their death. That's a Greek idea. Like, that you have a part of your body that is not corporeal, not made of matter, that marches on afterwards. Like, that's a completely new idea to people in the Jewish world. But also this idea that, like, the body's kind of bad, right? It's, like, linked to sex and want, like, passions that are bad and so on. This is just not a Jewish idea. Before the time of the Greek, the meeting, sort of the melding of the Greek and Jewish mindset. So Philo actually follows this and says, yeah, the world of matter decomposes, it decays. Plato was right about that. So thought or philosophy is a way of kind of getting in touch with like the spiritual side of ourselves, right? Like the part that doesn't have any matter, right? When our thoughts are kind of free or can be free of our matter. We can think things that don't exist. So let's focus on that. So he's trying to kind of build this philosophical system that ties together Greek and Jewish ideas. Okay, so what does Philo say about creation? I've mentioned this a few times, but let's take a look at a couple of texts. All right, this is like, translated in not translated terribly well, but it's in kind of stilted English, but you'll get this. Okay, so Philo starts his book on the creation. Remember, he's writing to an audience that is Jewish, but Jewish that's thoroughly Greek in their education system, et cetera. So he says, of other lawgivers, some have set forth what they consider to be a just and reasonable kind of law, right? Like, well, I'm going to make a law, I'm going to make a good law, like where justice reigns. Okay, in a naked and unadorned manner, while others, investing their ideas with an abundance of amplification, have sought to bewilder the people by burying the truth under a heap of fabulous inventions. So you can use law to try to get people or make justice. Okay, great. And you can kind of invent like reasons that you have a law or you're making a law and so on. But Moses, rejecting both of these methods, the one is inconsiderate, careless, and unphilosophical. The other is mendacious and full of trickery, made the beginning of his laws entirely beautiful and in all respects admirable. Neither at once declaring what ought to be done to the contrary, nor, since it was necessary to mold beforehand the dispositions of those who were to use his laws, inventing fables himself or adopting those which had been invented by others. Okay, so why does he begin his book this way? This is his big book on Genesis, basically. Why would Philo begin this way? Because if you say this is a law book, Moses gives the law, and it starts with the creation of the world. If you look at the Code of Georgia annotated, the official Code of Georgia, you know, our law book, you know, it doesn't start with the creation of the world. It's a really weird way to start a law code, right? You can't read all of Genesis through Deuteronomy and be like, oh, that's a good law code right there, right? It looks strange to the ancient people. It looks strange to us, too, if you call it a law code. But he says, this is why we're starting. We need to start with the creation of the world. That's why Moses starts his law this way. It's primarily because, well, if you're going to really talk about the law, and if the law is the right way of doing things, and if righteousness is tied up the whole way the cosmos is constructed, like Plato says, well, then of course you would start with creation itself. If the laws of the universe are tied up with our own laws, like how we should live is tied up with the larger system of how the world works and the cosmos works, well, then you got to start at the very beginning, right? So his exordium, so Moses' words, as I've already said, is most admirable, embracing the creation of the world under the idea that the law corresponds to the world and the world to the law. That is to say, like the universe and God's moral law and our interior law, all those things are linked with each other. God used the same kind of blueprint for all these things. And we'll get to his blueprint in just a moment. So, and then a man who's obedient to the law, being so, by so doing, a citizen of the world, arranges his actions with reference to the intention of nature in harmony with which the whole universal world is regulated. The whole world is regulated by the same law that's in our hearts, that's in the cosmos and in the stars, and so on. Math, right? The principles of mathematics are like symbolic of ourselves and our being and so on, right? And what's crazy is that, like, this sounds strange to us today. No, of course, like, the movement of the stars is the link to how I should treat my mom, right? You know, like, these are very different things, right? But the more you get into, like, particle physicists and, you know, folks who are involved in, like, the kind of outer boundaries of mathematics, the more esoteric and strange they actually get, right? Have you ever, like, heard the particle physicist end up kind of talking about, like, well, now that we've kind of figured out that, like, basically things pop in and out of existence at random, like, you know, like, and the physical universe doesn't work in the way we thought it does at all, like, you know, quantum physicists and so on. Well, then, I guess, we've got to start thinking in pretty mystical ways, right? Yeah, so, anyway, all to say, like, that Philo might be having a return, a resurgence here. Accordingly, no one, whether poet or historian, could ever give expression in an adequate manner to the beauty of his ideas respecting the creation of the world. So this is Philo saying, I know it's not good science. They already knew it wasn't good science. So, I mean, like I said, in Philo's day, they already had calculations about the circumference of the earth that were actually accurate. They knew how far away the sun was. In not in miles, but in stadia, their version of, miles. Whatever. So, all to say, they knew a lot about the world. Philo knows that this is not good science. But no one, whether poet or historian, could ever give expression in an adequate manner to the beauty of his ideas regarding the creation of the world. You can't put this into words. They all surpass the power of language and amaze our hearing, being too great and venerable to be adapted to the sense of any created being. That, however, is not a reason for our yielding to indolence in the subject. You got to say something about creation, even if you can't. I mean, if a particle physicist starts to explain the origins of the world and so on, none of us are going to understand it. Right? Even the person explaining it doesn't understand how it actually worked. They're always going to say, well, this is a guess here, and we don't quite know, and we can't even really explain this part, and so on. So we can't explain it, but we have to. We have to try. We have to try to put it into words, right? So that, however, is not a reason for yielding to indolence in the subject. We can't let it go, but rather from our affections for the deity. And here he's like, you know, he's using this word, this kind of vague word for God, like Plato does. We ought to endeavor to exert ourselves even beyond our powers in describing them. So we've got to try. Not having as much or indeed anything to say of our own, but instead of much, just a little, such as it may be probable that human intellect may attain to when wholly occupied with love and desire for wisdom. In other words, why does Genesis 1 in poetry? It's the best you can do. It's the closest you can get to actually explaining the creation of the world. Yeah.
So ultimately, this is trying to take everything unexplainable, mm-hmm. the mysteries, and put it into some context for a community that can have a foundational piece or an authority that you can always go to when you can't go to it.
Right. And so Philo is trying to say, look, this text is not like the answer book to the world, which is what some people even today treat it, right? But so how, my analogy here is, how do Christians deal with science in the Bible? Philo is actually showing us a quite interesting way for us to think about the relationship between science, which we know that 6 days is kind of hard to stack up to, like what we know about, you know, the concepts of thermodynamics, right? I mean, it's hard for us to understand how the 6 days would work historically, right? So, or scientifically. But what Philo is trying to say, I think, has some legs, and did in the ancient world. Sorry, this is a long quote, but this is a really important one, too, because it kind of pushes on this point. For some people, admiring the world itself rather than the creator of the world, having represented it as existing without any maker and eternal. So some people in the Greek world and today said there was no maker, right? He's really talking about these schools of thought, like the Epicureans who say there's no divine will and so on. You know, it's just get with the program, right? Some people admire the world itself rather than the creator of the world, have represented it as existing without any maker and eternal. And as impiously and as falsely have represented God as existing in a state of complete inactivity. So some people would say, well, there is a God, but kind of they don't care about us. You know, it's like this is the deist idea, right? So while it would have been right on the one hand to marvel at the might of God as creator and father of all, and to admire the world in a degree not exceeding the bounds of moderation, so here's this dig at the Epicureans, but Moses, who had early reached the very summits of philosophy, and he has a little, you know, this is in accordance with the description of the Bible, where he's represented as being learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. So Moses learned so much from the Egyptians, all the secrets of the Egyptians, right? And who had learned from the oracles of God the most numerous and important principles of nature. Huge difference between Philo and the Greeks, which is going to be hugely important for Christians too. That is to say, Christians become Greek philosophers. That's hypostasis, ousia, all the debates that inform what we say about the Trinity are all based on Greek philosophy. Sorry, that's just the way it is. Now, what he's trying to say is there's something else besides Greek philosophy here, and that's revelation, which the Greeks don't believe in. Greeks don't believe in, ancient Greek philosophers don't believe in divine revelation, that God spoke something to us and gave us a text. So he says we've got science, but we've also got a text. We have to think about it in context, right? We have to think about it not as like just giving us all the answers. They're oracles of God. They're poems that we have to read and interpret. Numerous and important principles of nature was well aware that it is indispensable that in all existing things there must be an active cause and a passive subject. Here he's arguing something that Thomas Aquinas argues in the Middle Ages. Many people still argue the watchmaker idea of the creation of the universe, right? Philo's got that 1,000 years before Thomas Aquinas. And what he's saying is, if there's something that gets created, something had to have created it. You know, like if something's moving, something had to push it. Right? So something just came from somewhere. That's the way that thermodynamics works, right? So he's literally got this argument already. He's the source of it, really. So a passive subject, and that active cause is the intellect of the universe. The intellect of the universe, God's ideas, which he turns into a second part of God. Philo says there's three parts of God. Philo the Jew says there's three parts of God. He's speaking before the time of Jesus, or during Jesus' lifetime. He says there's three parts of God. There's God the Father. He says there's the active God, that is the part of God that is active in the world creating. There's kind of the removed part of God that's like beyond all thought. There's the part of God that gets involved in creation. And then there's the Logos, this idea, the ideas of God that function like God's plan for the whole world and all time, that holds the whole world together, that's really imbued and kind of in all things. I don't know if this sounds familiar to you. Philo was hugely, he was a philosopher who laid the foundations for Trinitarian thought. So he remains a good Jew, but or at least you know, today people would argue that, but you know, for Eli, he was being a good Jew. The passive subject is something inanimate and capable of motion. God acts on this inanimate stuff. And gives us all energy in the world comes from God, is what he's saying. For reason, this proves that the Father and Creator has a care for that which has been created. For a father is anxious for the life of his children. So God must care about us because God started all this stuff. This stuff is moving. God made it. So God's got to care about it, right? You know, this is kind of, I mean, you could put this in Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis and it would work. Moses says the world made in 6 days, not because the Creator stood in need of a length of time, it's natural that God should do everything at once, not by uttering a command or by even thinking of it, is God operates outside time, so 6 days is an idea for us. It's to help us. 6 days, right? So he's trying to, this is like poetic, right? God doesn't even need time. He gets this idea from Plato. Plato says God doesn't create in time. The world has always existed, according to Plato, because it was outside of time that it began. So, like, time works now, is what they're saying from our perspective. Because things created required arrangement, and number is akin to arrangement. And of all numbers, six is, by the laws of nature, the most productive. For of all the numbers, from the unit upwards, from one upwards, it's the first perfect one, being made equal to its parts. He's doing Pythagorean mathematics on this. Yeah, he's doing symbolic number stuff, right? Why is six important? Three is half of it, and two is a third of it, and the unit is six. He's doing Pythagorean mathematics, not because he likes geometry, but precisely because this is helping him understand that there's a spiritual power to this number. And then the Word of God, the Logos of God, surpasses even that beauty which exists in nature, which is perceptible by the external senses. So he says, like, this universal plan that God had before time. Jews would also call this the Torah. That is to say, like, in Jewish tradition, the Torah is, like, the foundational principle by which God made the universe, the plan for it. So this is, you know, Jesus in Christian tradition and the Torah in Jewish tradition are kind of, like, side by side, right? In the same way that, like, in the Muslim tradition, Muhammad and Jesus aren't parallel, the Muslim parallel to Jesus is the Quran. That's the Word of God. The Torah is the equivalent to Jesus in the Jewish tradition, right? The Torah is an equivalent to the New Testament. The Torah is equivalent to Jesus, the embodiment of God's presence and the plan, the logos of all nature. Okay, so I know that we're running up against time. But he basically says, you know, Moses was a philosopher who created all of philosophy. Augustine, many centuries later, one of the most famous Christian theologians, right, borrows this thought and says, usually, even a non-Christian knows something about the earth, the heavens, other elements of this world, about the motion and orbit of the stars, even their size and relative positions, about the predictable eclipses of the sun and moon, the cycles of the years and seasons, about the kinds of animals, shrubs, stones, and so forth. And this knowledge he holds as being from a certain reason and experience. That is, Greek people are smart. Roman people are smart. They know a lot of science. Now it's a disgraceful and dangerous thing. He's saying this in his commentary on the literal meaning of Genesis. Now it's a disgraceful and dangerous thing for a non-Christian to hear a Christian, presumably giving the meaning of Holy Scripture, talking nonsense on these topics about science. And we should all take the means to prevent such an embarrassing situation in which people show a vast ignorance in a Christian and laugh it to scorn. So if, like, don't tell people Genesis 1 is science, Augustine said, right? You know, in other words, there must be another way to read this, right? Philo also talks about, this is just another example, circumcision, right? I bring this up because this is important for Paul. Philo talks about circumcision. Why do we cut our flesh? That is, the men of the Jewish culture, why do the Greeks think this is ridiculous? You're cutting your sex organ? Like, this, you know, it doesn't make any sense to the Greeks, right? So Philo is saying, well, the ordinance of circumcision of parts of generation, that is, men's penises, is ridiculed, though it's an act which is practiced to no slight degree in other nations also, most especially the Egyptians. The Egyptians have always circumcised. So, all to say, it's an ancient Near Eastern practice. Which appears to me the most populous of all nations are. So he said, why do we do this? Well, he gives two reasons. The first is, they're both symbolic. He says, the first reason that we do this is because it marks our organ of pleasure so that we, every time we see it, we think, I have done something to this that involves God. Am I always going to be driven by my pleasure? In other words, am I going to think with my penis all the time? No, I'm not. When I look at my penis, I'm actually marked so that I should not think with this thing, right? Don't let this drive me, right? It's a literal mark about passions, right? Trust God, and you know, it's not don't use this thing, it's that use this thing only in right ways, right? For the good of all people, et cetera, right? But then also he says, there's another reason we do this, and it's about power. And actually, this is how the Egyptians understood it, too, is that men were circumcised in ancient Egypt in order to remove their part of, like, you know, phallic symbols in ancient Egypt are the same as in the United States, where people build towers, you know, which symbolize things, right? You know, all to say, you're cutting off the tip of your own symbol of power in order to remind yourself when you exercise power, I have given something to God. The Egyptians said this, too, and the Jews, you know, borrow this as well. Now, the difference is that Paul ends up using some of this logic too. Circumcision is symbolic. Now, Paul goes somewhere where Philo doesn't go. That is, Paul says, so you don't necessarily need it. Mm-hmm. Philo says you still need it. You still need the physical symbol. But you can see how Paul is following these allegorical interpretations. Personally, I think Paul knows Philo. I think he's read Philo. And I think he's learning from Philo. So there's a lot more... But I want to end with this, thinking about the logos together, right? The most important system, part of a Philo system is the logos. This ends up being hugely important for John. In the beginning was the word. He's like, John is borrowing this idea from Jewish Greek philosophers like Philo. Philo is the most important. He's probably read Philo. That is to say, also, I think, although he doesn't use this word in exactly the same way, I do think Paul is heavily influenced by this. There's a lot to say here, but let me just read a couple of quotes. These are amazing. This is from Philo on the Logos. The Logos, God begat eternally. God begat the Logos eternally. The Logos comes from something, but God didn't just in a moment in time create the Logos. It's always been emanated by God. Sounds like the Nicene Creed. This is what the Christians end up saying about Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a manifestation of God's thinking and acting. My own soul told me, he says, he kind of hears this, God telling us, that in the one living and true God, there were two supreme and primary powers, goodness and authority, and that by his goodness he created everything, and by his authority he governs. But that there's a third thing between the two, and that's the Logos that unifies these two natures of God. God's goodness and God's authority, God's work in the world, and God's kind of behind the scenes. Holy Spirit working in the world on behalf of God, and God the Father behind the screen, and what's between them is the Logos, the emanation of God's power into the world. Good God. Like, this is pretty clear, right? That early Christians are, this is before early Christianity, right, exists. So this is creating a pattern by which early Christianity emerges. These are creating resources that Christians then rely on in order to explain the strangeness of Jesus, right? So in the Father who created the universe has given his archangel and most ancient Logos a preeminent gift to stand in the confines of both and separate that which has been created from the Creator. So the Logos is what holds apart the Creator but holds together the Creator and the creation. And this same Logos is continually a suppliant to the immortal God on behalf of the mortal race. The Logos is the intermediary that prays on behalf of the people to God, the Father. You hear this? Yeah, okay. Yeah. And the Logos rejoices, right? Saying, I stood in the midst between the Lord and you. That's Moses in Numbers who says that, but this is the Logos. Moses is showing us what the Logos does. Neither being uncreated as God, nor being created like you, but being in the midst between these two extremities. Like a hostage, as it were, to both parties. You know, kind of like held between them, right? For it was indispensable that the man who was consecrated to the Father of the world, the high priest, should have a paraclete, his son. You know, have you ever heard that word before, the paraclete? Yeah. This is the word that the Gospel of John uses to mean the Holy Spirit. Right? All to say, this is a word that has already been used in Greek, Jewish Greek philosophy and theology to explain God's activity in the world. And last, these three, kind of three parts of God. I won't go into detail on this, but just to say, the Wisdom of Solomon is another book that's a contemporary of Philo's. Some people link it to Philo, that Philo read this, or that this person read Philo. That goes on to kind of create a book a lot like Proverbs, but that's written from this Greek philosophical perspective, written initially in Greek and so on, but it talks about the Logos. It gives a whole poem about the Logos that fits with Greek philosophy. This is the context into which John is writing. John's writing John 1, which hopefully we'll hear a lot this Advent season, right? And into the Christmas season. But that is to say that this doesn't get spoken into a vacuum from a vacuum. It's spoken into a thick, deep, rich culture that has already been built for millennia, right? But that is slightly new. It's different what John is doing with the Logos, but it's not coming out of nowhere. So all to say that Philo, I think, and I'm going to come back to Philo when we talk about the New Testament sometimes, because I think he is hugely important. I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Like, I think God gave us Philo as someone to help build a bridge between between Judaism and the culture that really took hold, where Christianity took hold among the barbarians, who were educated as Greeks, really, and Romans, right? That is to say, this is kind of a bridge that Paul relies on heavily. That's why we're here today, right? I think Philo is a crucial part in God's bridge building in the world. So, all to say, here's my little picture of Paul. Absolute last thing, Caligula. So there's three riots that happen in Alexandria where the Jews are persecuted by the Romans and Greeks, which begin to get very upset at how wealthy and powerful that they're getting, and that the Jews refuse to fully conform, partly because of the work of people like Philo. They refuse to fully conform to Roman and Greek culture, and they stick out a bit, and they're powerful and wealthy. And so the Alexandrian people begin to kind of riot against them. And then there's in 38 CE, there's a massive riot where, of all people, Philo is chosen as the representative to Caligula, the Roman emperor. And he goes to Rome and pleads on behalf of the Jewish people to please don't persecute us or kick us out of the empire. And he actually succeeds. That is to say that the Jews are allowed to continue to live in Alexandria and so on. In 66 CE, there's a war between Rome and Judah, which we'll talk about next semester. Maybe we'll even talk about it next week. But Rome, this is the destruction of the temple, right, after the time of Jesus. There's a war, really, that emerges all throughout the Jewish populated areas of the Roman world. That is, Rome, Jews in Alexandria revolt, too. And then they are also persecuted in those areas because there's a war going on in Judea. So there's a second Alexandrian riot. And the third one, in 117, there's a massive rebellion of Jewish people throughout the Roman world. An amazing story that has hardly ever been told, the Quitos Revolt, where Jews actually massacre Roman legions all throughout the Roman world and win for a long time. And then there's a huge Roman crackdown, as you might imagine, which lands the second destruction of Jerusalem and the abolishment of Jews from, or you know, it's made illegal for Jews to enter Jerusalem until like the year 900 about. So Jerusalem is made, fully remade as a Roman city after that. But anyway, and also say that Philo goes there and he's the one who pleads his way. This is from the Nuremberg Chronicles, so definitely not Philo here. But anyway, I'll end there. But next week is our last week for this semester, and we'll talk about the Roman Empire and Herod. So we'll really focus on, we got up to the time of Herod. We'll really talk about Herod and Herod's children, and why is Pontius Pilate, a guy probably from Scotland, not kidding, positioned as the Roman governor in Judea. All right, see you next week.
This podcast is a ministry of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta. Come join us Sundays at 189 Church Street, Marietta, Georgia, or visit us online at fpcmarietta.org.